This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, when we lose power, one of the first things we think of is what's in the fridge, what's in the freezer. Those big white boxes in our kitchens are now vital in our modern lives. But fridges, they pretty much started out as underground cool rooms, just big holes in the ground. And now they've changed so much. Many of us have smart fridges, some so far that they're barcode scanners, fridges that automatically alter the temperature depending on the food that you have in there. They'll even tell you when food is reaching its expiry. Some fridges, believe it or not, even print you a grocery list. But as many of us now are trying to conserve energy and money with the cost of living, what do we think about the future of our fridges? In the off-the-grid world, we're now seeing a shift back to cool rooms. And in the UK, there is a ground fridge movement. So will we see that here in Victoria? But speaking of Victoria, that's where refrigeration all started. One day back in the 1850s, a very clever Geelong man, whilst fishing, turned to his mate and had an idea. He thought of a way to make ice, and that was the beginning of refrigeration. Now many Geelong locals are calling for greater recognition of this man, James Harrison, and they're calling for a museum. As you may have seen on ABC TV yesterday on Landline, Tim Lee has been looking into the life of this Geelong fellow who pretty much changed the way we live. And Tim will join you in just a moment. But growing up, you might be the same as me, it was very different. We had a huge chest freezer in the fridge. It was full of meat. It was full of bread. We had another big fridge in the shed as well. That was just for drinks. But now our freezer here at my house is small. It's so small it only fits maybe one loaf of bread and a tub of ice cream. Because our lives now are geared towards eating more fresh produce. But as food prices go up and as food prices rise, will we see a change back? Will the chest freezer make a return? And many living in regional Victoria still have them. So today on the Conversation Hour, what is the future of fridges? In a world where we try to use less energy, how will refrigeration change? And how many fridges and freezers do you have in your home? And maybe you remember your first fridge.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
And if you tuned into Landline on ABC TV yesterday, you would have seen that Tim Lee, well, he has been deep diving on a man that we know nothing about, but we should be thanking on a daily basis. And that is James Harrison, who, well, some would say, Tim, is the inventor of the fridge.
Rochelle, all inventions are keenly contested. Who did it first? And James Harrison had some really big world breakthroughs. I think he built on the back of other known science, but he had a kind of eureka moment, strange enough, in a cave in a place called Rocky Point by the Barwon River, where he was mucking around with trying to capture the gas that escaped when you put ether onto metal. And as you probably experience sometimes, there's a cold sensation. So he, as you say, he was actually fishing when he mentioned to a mate, and he did some fishing on the side. He was actually the founding editor, believe it or not, of the Geelong Advertiser, a journalist, and he's got so much in his background, James Harrison, but this incredible inventor, gone to night school, knew a bit about chemistry. So he almost blew himself up a couple of times in this cave, and that, though, was the key crucial part about getting this idea, which had been around for, you know, really 100 years. How do we get refrigeration? So, he's quite a man.
What I find incredible is that within this story, we've also discovered that we once imported ice. I can't get my head around that. Like, my brain can't quite comprehend the idea of importing ice, but that's what we did. And it wasn't until James Harrison found a way to make ice that we then saw the beginnings of refrigeration. But that has changed there's so our, the way that we live on so many levels, not just, you know, what we keep in our fridge and freezer, but what we export, you know, what we import, looking at transportation, there's huge onflow effects from this invention that happened in Geelong.
Pretty much every aspect of our life relies on refrigeration. Even, you know, COVID vaccines need refrigeration. And some people come to this story because they discover that James Harrison invented this means of making cheap commercial ice, which then led to a revolution in Pilsner beer, because suddenly that was better when it was frozen or cooled down. So amazing sort of fellow. Why don't we know more about him? I tell you, someone who's done a lot of thought on this is Graham Hobbs. Graham's a retired solicitor from Geelong, and he's for 25 years been at the helm of the James Harrison Museum Committee. Graham, why don't we know more about James Harrison?
G'day, good morning. Graham. In answer to your question, I think because he didn't end up as a multimillionaire, he was a brilliant man, a genius, who basically thought about the cooling effect of ether on the wooden typeprints when he was setting up the Geelong Advertiser on a fortnightly basis in the 1840s. And he had this cooling effect, and he thought, bit of pressure on this. He'd been to a nascent university in Scotland, because he came from the banks of the Leven, and his parents were, his father was a salmon fisherman, so that's why he had the interest in fish. And in England, you don't need to cool it as much, but in Australia it's a bit hotter, so you need a bit of ice. And so he thought about how can we preserve initially the fish, and then he thought about a bit of pressure and dropping ether to a particular temperature, and the ice crystals formed. And as Tim said, he almost blew himself up a couple of times, because you might put yourself back into the situation. It's 1840. There's 400 people in Geelong. Melbourne's just been founded in 1835. The metalwork was, you know, fairly basic, etc. But he managed to get a chap named Scott, who was an iron maker, an iron monger, I think they called him in those days. And so he did a bit of work on that, and he created the first commercial ice making machines in the world. He had a contact with a Frenchman who had basically been really involved in working out the deep sea diving helmets, and he contacted him, and he went across to England and he perfected it and came back, and he was making tons of ice in the 1850s in Geelong, and he started industries, and people were... That's really good. He's a fantastic guy.
We don't realise, Graham, do we? Rochelle referred to there, but we brought in big shiploads of ice from harvested mostly from frozen lakes in North America. They were carefully brought out here in insulated ships, and ice was really pretty valuable to get it out to the hot gold fields and places. We were a very rich, prosperous economy, but this breakthrough was pretty sizable from what we know, having ice.
As you mentioned before, in relation to the beer industries, they were really fascinated. And Bendigo was having a bit of beer there, and after a while, because you need to reduce the temperature of the wort when you're making your beer, as explained to me by a brewer not so long ago, and the machines were in Peru, England, other parts of Australia, and Europe. So he started with an idea, and it spread. And then he thought, okay, we have plenty of meat here, sheep everywhere. Let's get it back to the home country.
And isn't that so incredible? It's just changed everything from transportation and exportation as well. Graham Hobbs is with you. He's a retired solicitor now, based in Geelong, but spent the last 25-odd years at the helm of the James Harrison Museum Committee. We'll get to that in just a moment as to why we should have a museum in his honour. But stay with us, Graham. Kathy's in Northcote. Kathy, welcome. What did you want to say?
Your programs are always wonderful. They're so the topics are always so interesting. This morning I've identified with this particular topic because when I was a youngster in the 50s, baby boomer, we didn't have refrigerators. We had ice blocks. that came with the Iceman, and he would come with his truck, and they had this huge, you couldn't call them a brick, and he had a Hessian bag over his shoulder, and he would have these huge blocks that he would put into your ice fridge because there was no electricity. And if you were a lucky little one, he would give you a little chip off it to suck on it in summer. And once it went, over the week, it just melted and melted and melted and melted. And you ended up with just with, you know, constant cleaning out the ice bit at the top where our freezers would be now that electrified. They weren't electrified. So you're just constantly cleaning out that sort of water that had melted. And it was, and everybody knew the Iceman, and you know, you hear him coming down the street, and you know, you'd run out because it was a really hot summer or whatever, and he'd give you a little chip off the ice block.
Oh, Kathy,
and
that's,
I think,
so great.
That's where that term comes, a chip off the block, right, comes from.
Kathy, thank you so much. It wasn't that long ago, Tim. I mean, we've received a text as well saying, Rish and Tim, I lived on the country as a child. I remember the Coolgardie safe and then the ice chests. We had a green ice chest. It was very similar in design to a fridge with rounded doors. It was very posh, says Judy in Mount Eliza. If you have those memories of the Iceman, or if your fridge was underground, or the first time, you know, you received a fridge, as you know, an electric fridge as we know it today now, Tim. Tim, how many fridges have you got at your place? I haven't asked.
We've actually, because we live in the country, got a second fridge, and it makes life really easy. You can put all the meat and dairy in one and all the other things in the other. So it's it actually is a bit of a life, just because we shop at, perhaps as few times as once a week. So it's terrific. But I guess the question, we're talking to Graham Hobbs here from Geelong. Graham, where is the museum idea at? You've even had plans drawn up. Is it dead in the water? Do you still have hope it will happen in your time?
I'd love it to happen in my time. Bruce Webster was the dynamo of our group. We had 18, and we also had Jim Harrison, who's basically a grandson of the original James. And we had, as you say, plans drawn up. We had the land allocated to us at Rocky Point. But really, I think it might be an opportunity at this particular stage, because Geelong has, in 2017, received the designation of Australia's only UNESCO City of Design. Now, I think this is a lead-in for a number of world firsts which Geelong's provided. For example, you know, you did an article on Branch Ute, and there's Toyne's Rotary Hoist, Devlin's decimal currency of 38 countries, the carbon fibre breakthroughs at Deakin University, and Dr. Matt Dingle's amazing corrugated iron form flow designs. So I reckon it's a great opportunity at this particular stage to have a centre of original designs and put it in Geelong, because where James started it all.
Well, keep up the good work.
Yeah, incredible the amount of, I guess, design and the way our lives have changed, that's all come out of Geelong. Graham Hobbs, thank you so much for joining us and sharing just a little bit of James Harrison's life with us. And best of luck with the museum. Keep us up to date with what happens.
My absolute pleasure. And every time we open the fridge, we should say, thanks, James.
Given my household and how often my daughter's at it, we'd be saying that very often. Graham Hobbs, thanks for your time. He's a part of the James Harrison Museum Committee. If you remember, you know, the Iceman, if you remember your first fridge, and just how you've seen fridges and freezers change. As I said, I remember the huge big chest freezer in our shed full of meat. My mum would buy meat in bulk, and that's just, you know, we never bought meat from the supermarket, or we never went to the butcher. It was just always in the freezer, and it was a cost thing. And I reckon, Tim Lee, we will start to slowly see a shift back to that. And I know it already happens in the country. Warwick Long, you know, presenter of the Country Hour and a co-host with me, he said, oh, mate, I've got two chest freezers. You know, I've got it's meat there for a year or 2 years worth. And whether or not that will become even more important as things like meat become a luxury for so many of us, because they've become really expensive. Pauline's in Port Melbourne. Hi, Pauline.
Hello. Hi. I just happened to be in the city a week or so ago and came across a plaque at 100 Franklin Street honouring James his work, James Harrison, and it's the building where the original Victorian Iceworks was founded by him.
And did you know much about him, Pauline? Or did you stop and have
no.
a look? Or, right.
No, yeah, I stopped and I like reading the plaques around town. And of course, this was rather unusual about Iceworks. It's up near the market, Victoria Market.
Oh, great. Well, we'll have to check it out and, you know, have a look. Pauline, thank you. David's in Casterton. Hi, David. Welcome to the conversation.
How are you?
Good. What do you want to say?
Oh, just back in the 1950s, I was living in North Melbourne as a kid, and the Buller Cream Factory there, they used to get semi-trailers come down from Colac transporting the big cans of milk and cream, and they were all kept cool by ice blocks, big chunks of ice, and we'd help the guy unload them, and then he'd give us some ice to take home for our ice chest.
Win-win.
Yeah.
Pretty nice memories, aren't they, when you've got an ice cream attached to it?
It was good.
We've got James Harrison's great-great-grandson on the line as well, who I think still got a fairly inventive type of brain from what I know. Mark Harrison, how are you this morning?
Yeah, fine there, Tim.
Good to hear. Now, just tell us what you do as a job. It seems to me that you've got some inventiveness in your genes.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I'm only the great-grandson.
Great-grandson. So, sorry, I put an extra one there.
Slow breeders. I think James has inspired the whole family to sort of take up the inventive nature and practical means of getting things done. So, myself, I'm an electronics engineer, and I've been working on the bionic ear and the bionic eye and various other types of biomedical devices my whole life now, approaching retirement at this stage. My sons have sort of taken on similar types of work. So there's something in the genes, I think.
Yeah, it really is. It's wonderful today to learn so much about James Harrison, and many people, you know, even like Pauline, our last caller, didn't know anything about him, yet we all have a connection to refrigeration. You know, it's something that we all use on a daily basis. As a family, you know, do you tell stories of your great-grandfather? Are those stories passed down? Like, how is his legacy remembered just within your family?
Yeah, there have been a lot of stories that have been passed down, but a lot of it has been documented as well, particularly in a book written by Roy Leng. And there's also an auntie of ours who's following the family tree and discovering things. It seems every month or two she finds another interesting fact about James Harrison and the rest of the family. Which is quite exciting.
Wow, it's quite an inspiring sort of ancestry you've got there, Mark. I guess the question is, why don't we know more about James?
Yeah, well, you wonder. There's a few clues spread around the place, like the James Harrison Bridge in Geelong across the Bowen, I should say, and things like that. But and I think the kids in school in Geelong particularly possibly aware of him more than anywhere else. But I think, as Graham said, you know, he didn't make a lot of money, and so he hasn't sort of really been remembered. And a lot of other people, of course, have gone on to develop the refrigeration machinery and industry into what it is today.
Isn't it incredible when you think about how vital his invention is, and yet he didn't personally, well, financially anyhow, benefit from that? And quite often, and look, it might be just I've watched one too many Hollywood films, the inventor is often sort of seen as the mad one. This is never going to work, or what are you trying to do here? Was there an element of, oh, well, this Harrison bloke is crazy? Like, how was it perceived, do you know, at the time?
I think particularly with his work on using volatile chemicals like ether, people thought he was pretty crazy, and he almost proved the point by blowing himself up a couple of times. And that's why he was in a cave and not in a building in the middle of Geelong. But there is some of that.
Isn't there a plaque out near the cave? Isn't there some kind of plaque near the cave? Yeah, right. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, you can't see the cave anymore. It's been filled in.
It's a pity, isn't it, Mark? We scrambled danger, up. Yeah, it's a pity the cave's not there. It's really a very significant site, but there's just a rock-strewn hillside with tangled overgrowth, really.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you like to see a museum? I mean, there has been a big call, to, you know, coming close to 25 years now that locals in Geelong would like to see a museum in honour of your great-grandfather alongside some of the other incredible inventions that have happened in Geelong. Is that something your family would want to see?
Oh, yes, certainly. I think it's something that's worth remembering and more particularly to inspire young people into, you know, taking on these kind of inventions themselves, if they have a good idea, you know, don't just forget about it. Try and bring it to fruition.
We hope so.
Yeah, Mark, thanks so much for your time, and thank you for the work that you do as well. I mean, I know that you've been working as a part of the cochlear ear inventions as well, which have literally changed people's lives. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, no worries. I've only played a small part in it, but it's been a really good, interesting thing to be involved in. Thanks very much.
It's Mark Harrison, the great-grandson of James Harrison. You must have had a ball, Tim Lee, putting this show together for Landline. You quite seriously have one of the best jobs, you know, being able to drive around and discover these people within our own communities that change our lives on a daily basis. How great.
It's fantastic fun, and it's a bit of, a chance to be a bit artistic too. So there was a hand model there. We went to a sort of a pioneer village at Griffith, actually, so we found an old printing press and the fairly dark smeared hands were mine in the piece, but we thought, how the hell do we illustrate this, you know, something that happened in the 1840s, 1850s. So that's a great bit of fun. But it is a real joy just having people contact you with some element of the story, because a lot of these stories are quite fragmented and there's no often one real answer to what this bloke was doing. It's impossible to know some of this stuff at this distance. But there's been some pretty good work done, though, and one of those really on the case as well is a very passionate member of the National Trust in Geelong, and that's Lex Chalmers. Lex, you've been on the case for a while as well, trying to better memorialise James Harrison. Why so?
Well, I've been the chair of the National Trust branches, the Geelong branches, UNESCO Design Week subcommittee. And our brief is to run an event for Geelong's annual UNESCO Design Week held in March. I've just finished running tours of Geelong's 20th century architecture through the CBD. And that was the 2022 contribution to Design Week. And in 2020, we were the people on the committee said what the theme for Design Week was: unpredictable. And in my ignorance, I said, what could be more unpredictable than James Harrison, the Addy founder and editor and owner, after he'd set up the press for John Pascoe Faulkner, he bought the press within 2 years at a 10 times inflated price of £300 and became the owner. What could be more unpredictable than the career of James Harrison after doing that, which is pretty remarkable? He invents refrigeration.
And Lex, you point to, I put this question to you with the Landline segment, but you think that crucially his big failure was in 1872, 1873. He got public subscription to send a big boatload of frozen mutton. We had a surplus of mutton here. It goes from Geelong on the Norfolk with lots of fanfare, high expectation. He was his breakthrough that was going to launch a new stage of exports from Australia. But tell us what happens. It gets to London docks and the punchline is?
Well, that was a visionary attempt. He had to throw the meat overboard because he wasn't concentrating on making sure that the insulation was perfect to put his frozen meat into the tanks so that the insulation would last the distance. And they got to London, there was anticipation, there was a great need for protein in England at the time. Butchers were lined up on the wharf and they all went away empty-handed.
Oh, gosh, isn't that incredible? Oh, that would keep you awake at night just knowing that it was that one thing that you didn't do. Lex, over the years, how much have you seen? I mean, we've got plenty of callers which we're going to go to in just a moment talking about just how they've seen refrigeration change. How have you seen it change from growing up through to the type of fridge that you have now?
Well, I said in the program, I can't imagine a world without refrigeration and air conditioning. I grew up until I was about 10 without either. We had the Coolgardie safe on the back veranda. And that's another story. It's got a tray of water on top. You have to keep the water up to it. Hessian sides of the safe and strips of Hessian in the tank of water, and water drips down the sides of the Coolgardie safe, and it maintains food about 5 degrees lower than the ambient temperature, because by the time and you have it in a breezy place, so that the breezes all catch, evaporate, and chill the water and chill the interior of the meat safe. So I grew up with that. I think I was maybe about 7 when we got a Kero fridge, but we didn't have a generator on our farm until I was about 14. And sometime later, we got an electrified refrigerator.
Wow.
Kero fridge was a bit of a beast.
You hear some terrible stories.
Really, oh, you really do. That's so wonderful. Lex, thank you. Thank you for your passion and your dedication to this. And I'm sure, you know, you will form a part of a long list that would like to see this museum opened in honour of James. Lex Chalmers, who is a part of the National Trust in Geelong, thanks for your time. Let's go to Shane. He's also in Geelong. Shane, where have you just been?
Hi. I've literally just been to the James Harrison piece of stone with the inlay on it just now. While I was walking, I watched Landline last night, and I was walking my dog around the bar one today, and I thought I'd pay respects to James just then. And it's right, he's right. It's literally a rocky outcrop just with growth all over it, and just a block of stone, a little block with a little plaque on it. And that everyone just walks past and no one pays any attention to. So I thought I'd pay my respects to him, and what a great job he's done.
And you had a cold drink after, yeah. I guess, did you? Went home for a cold drink?
Yeah, I probably will. But I was also going to say, I do remember, I came from a really small town in northern Victoria in the Mallee called Patchawalik, and I remember as a young boy before I left, we used to have the iceworks there, and they were no longer in use, but all the infrastructure was still there in a corrugated iron shed, and we used to play in it as boys and just, you know, play games in it. But the iceworks, the original iceworks, were still there, and all the pumps were there, and the ice room itself was there. It was about probably 4 metres by 3 metres. It was insulated with sawdust all the way around, and had a very strong door on the front that we used to tease each other by locking each other in because it was pitch black inside. And it was there, but all the foundations were there. All the big concrete slabs and the pumps, and yeah, it was amazing. We used to play on the pulley wheels and all sorts of things. But unfortunately, it's no longer there because, like all things in the 80s and 90s, it was unfashionable, I guess, and it eventually was scrapped, probably for scrap metal. But now I think, wow, that's, you know,
Well, you might have been trespassing, but it would have been fun, you know, and it's not there anymore. And I love the fact that Tim Lee, your piece on Landline, has inspired Shane to go for a walk today and walk past that cave. You know, there is a plaque out the front of a covered cave now to honour this man. Shane, good on you. I love to know that you've been inspired to do that. Let's go to another Shane now on Watsonia. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, I grew up in Mildura and I can relate to it. We had a Coolgardie safe and we also had an ice chest. The iceman would come every 3 days. We'd get half a block of ice every 3 days and, like a previous caller, a chip of ice, which was really good. So by the time you ate the middle out of the bread from the baker's cart and the pull by horse and a banana from the Chinese grocer, life was pretty good. But my mother was very worried. She wouldn't touch a kerosene refrigerator for anything because kerosene was way too dangerous. And a friend of hers had got an electric fridge from South Australia in Adelaide, and no, she wasn't going to have that either because she didn't want to leave an electric motor running all day and all night because she was worried that it might catch fire and burn the house down. But eventually in about 1958, she did import a refrigerator from Adelaide, not import, but bring across from Adelaide, a refrigerator that didn't have a freezer in it. It just had, or might have had this one small compartment. But, yeah, so we moved from the Coolgardie and the ice chest to the refrigerator.
Isn't that wonderful? I just can't believe, Shane, thank you. Tim, it's been a relatively short time to see this progression, to see how much fridges and freezers have evolved. And the fact that it all started in a cave, it just kind of spins me out a little bit. But I love these stories. I guess I've grown up with an electric fridge. You know, I can remember my first microwave, but a fridge was kind of just a given. They were big and they were boxy and they weren't nowhere near as fancy as what they are now. But they have evolved rapidly, haven't they, over a short period of time.
And some are just fantastic. We've got one on the farm, which is more than 50 years old. We haven't turned it off, a deep freeze. It fits nearly a whole cow and we have a cow killed. So it's fantastic, but we're not going to turn it off to clean it out. So it's
just let it go.
Essential, you know, when you're on a farm and you have some livestock to put into the freezer, you need a lot of space.
So what are the future of fridges? In a world where we try to use less energy, will refrigeration change?
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And you may have seen on Landline yesterday an incredible story into the history of James Harrison. Who's James Harrison? I hear you say, well, he is the man every time you go to the fridge. We've been told today, Tim Lee, we have to open it and say, thank you, James, because he pretty much invented refrigeration. He invented ice. There are many calling for a museum in honour of him. But we're sort of just learning today about not only our history of refrigeration, but also the future of refrigeration. Given that we live in smaller houses a lot of the time, our energy bills, not many of us can afford our energy bills. Food prices are going up. Will we start to freeze more? So will we start to see a shift in the types of fridges, the sizes of freezers that we have into the future as well? I think it will have to shift.
I think you're right. And it's funny, isn't it, at the moment with so few food shortages and things like that, it's brought it back in focus. So we take this so much for granted that we've got fresh food. Where does it go? And I guess if you think back 20 years ago, there was lots of talk about, CFCs coming out of your fridge and all the rest. There was a big kind of focus on that, how polluting was your fridge in terms of greenhouse emissions. So I guess that now is the other part of the equation we've got to look at. Where does that fit in too? So I guess really someone very well qualified to answer that is Tony Gleeson. Tony is the CEO of the Australian Institute of Refrigeration, Air Conditioning and Heating and joins us now. Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
Tony, we've gone through a bit there, but you really honour James Harrison as well. Certainly plenty of celebration about who James Harrison is, don't you, but with your organisation?
No, certainly from the background of James, our institute was formed in 1920. It's been going for now over 102 years, and institute a medal, a life honour each year under James Harrison's name. We also have named our building, the James Harrison Centre. we've also been involved in developing or helping to spread the word of James over that period of time, including there's various books been written about his life, so we promote that as well. But certainly he's the centre of our organisation.
And you celebrate James Harrison Day every year. So two questions there. What day do you celebrate it and how do you celebrate it? I'm thinking there's a lot of ice involved, just quietly.
Well, we're not sure on that, but it's on the 17th of April, James's birthday. Generally, we celebrate him by trying to promote his name and what he's been doing, and certainly showing the influence of what his work has had on our society and on even the greater world as well.
I've had people say to me they learned about this story because they saw a detail in a museum in Detroit in the USA. People have seen similar things elsewhere in the world. So what do we have to do to get this fellow better recognised, he and other refrigeration pioneers?
Well, I think, you know, if you have a look, there's actually a scale model in the British Museum as well. There's been at the Smithsonian Institute, he's been recommended there. And certainly early on in the, you know, certainly the 1920s, probably prior to the Second World War, he was well recognised within Australia. But it certainly dropped away in that space. It would be great to have a museum in his honour. There's still a lot of his work about, the basic work, the models, his notes, various things in there. But I think it's important to be able to recognise and celebrate this in some way. And it would be good to have the 17th of April recognised as James Harrison's Day federally in a way to celebrate innovation, certainly the impact it's had on the Australian economy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's not, as I've learnt today, thanks to Tim's incredible work with Landline, it's not just about the fridges and the freezers that we use, but, you know, our whole life, as we've learnt throughout COVID even more so, revolves around importation and exportation and getting food across waters for long distances. And that fundamentally was thanks to him. Tony, when you look at the future of refrigeration, we are living in a world now where we all, and rightly so, have big concerns about our environment. Many of us are concerned about the cost of our electricity bills. Where do you see the future of refrigeration? Will it be down the smart fridge line where there's computers and things in it that can do all sorts of snazzy stuff? Or will we go back to bare basics, do you think?
Oh, no, I think we're certainly going down that line of much more, computer-type controlled refrigerators, in terms of the way they're operated, more efficiency in terms of where they're actually being developed and so forth in that. One thing we should be aware of, the Australian government, over several governments, has implemented a phase-down of the refrigerants that are used in the refrigerators. And previously, there were high global warming potential refrigerants in our commercial refrigerators and household refrigerators. And the newer fridges coming out with very low global warming potential. Subsequently, that really the future of the fridge is that it would have very little impact on our carbon footprint. Currently, at the moment, the HVAC and R industry, we call it, has an impact of somewhere around about 12% on Australians' carbon footprint and uses up at peak about 24% of Australia's electrical energy. So we certainly have been a focus on trying to reduce that carbon footprint and reduce the electrical usage in this space. And there are a number of research going on currently at the moment, particularly at CSIRO, Melbourne University, Queensland University of Technology, and the Sustainability Institute at Wollongong University. They're all focused on these issues at the moment about reducing our carbon footprint, but more importantly, making our lives much more better by it.
Fantastic. Gosh.
Yeah, amazing. Tony, thanks for your time. Tony Gleeson is the CEO of the Australian Institute of Refrigeration and Air Conditioning and Heating. I didn't even know there was an Institute of Refrigeration, Air Conditioning and Heating. And do you know, strangely, researching today's show, Tim, not only, you know, did I watch Landline, but do you know who else is a very big refrigeration expert? Our very own Matt Preston, believe it or not, when he first came to Australia, he was the refrigeration and cooling reporter. That was like his first reporting gig. And we chewed the fat about refrigeration a lot.
That title, the refrigeration reporter.
Oh, no, it's wonderful, isn't it? Hey, Barbara's in Wantirna. Barbara, welcome.
My husband was a refrigeration engineer and he knew a lot about James Faulkner. He used to often talk about him and he's got several books on him.
Right, so you're well and truly aware of his legacy every time you open your fridge.
Yes, yes. Well, he served his apprenticeship as a refrigeration engineer. And he used to go around to the orchards and service all the orchards with all their cool rooms and that.
Barbara, that's wonderful memory. Oh, that's really lovely. Thank you. Barry's in Clifton Hill. Hi, Barry.
We lived up near Mildura, which is obviously a very hot environment, and our refrigerator was powered by kerosene, which seemed a bit strange that you have a flame generating cold air in a fridge. But it really struggled, and my mother used to try and make ice cream in these ice cream trays, but was only about a centimetre thick because you just couldn't get the temperature down low enough to make anything colder.
Oh, well, that sounds like my ice cream attempts here in our household. Good on you. Thank you. Well, James Pertle is the ABC technology reporter. James, we touched on before the future of fridges, and it feels like a few years ago. Fridges, you know, there was computers, touch screens in the front, and you could scan barcodes, and it would tell you if your food was due to expire. Are these the sort of fridges that we're all going to want into the future, do you think?
Hi. Yeah, it's been fascinating listening into the discussion. I don't think so. I think that was a gimmick. From about 2016, right, when we thought everyone would be having these fridges, and then it turns out they're actually not that useful because you can do everything that the smart fridge does just with a notepad, basically. it was sort of a way of showing off new technology and maybe trialing it and seeing if people were interested. But I think what we've learned from the last few years is home automation will go in a different direction to just adding a tablet to every device.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because one of the problems in the fridge is trying to tracking your leftovers, what date. So what, do you just put a label on your leftovers to say when you cook the rice or something rather than use the computer readout?
I'm nowhere near that organised, I'm afraid. I mean, yeah, in fact, back in the 90s, there was a Microsoft smart sort of concept home, and they were introducing this idea of barcode scanning and as part of that, automatic shopping, so that the fridge would know when you're running out of milk and would automatically order milk to arrive that day and so on. That was the idea in the 90s. It's incredibly complicated though when you think of it, because the fridge has to know what needs to arrive today and what can be put for later in the week because it's not so urgent. And it needs to somehow know if you're going to be going away or not, things like that. You can imagine it sort of going haywire and all this milk arriving on your doorstep.
I don't even like using the self-checkout at the supermarket, let alone having to scan food as it goes into our fridge. I feel really heartened that we didn't like where it was heading, and then we've just realised that, you know what, just keep it cold, keep it frozen, make sure the door just stays shut. That's generally a good start as well. That makes me have some faith in humanity, James.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think so too, that we sort of aren't getting sucked into these gimmicks. There are lots of other kinds of automation that are catching on, and sort of the gimmicks have shifted elsewhere to little robots that rove around the house and, lights that can change colour with your smartphone and things like that. But, that's really the story of automation for the last century. It's people coming up with these ideas and saying, why don't we live like this? And then other people who actually have to buy these products saying, no, actually, that just sounds like a lot of complication and happy to just stay with the fridge or...
And then potential for error. James, thank you so much. That's James Pertle. He's the ABC technology reporter. Tim Lee is with you as well. Tim, Vicky's called from Canberra. Now, Vicky, you have a very personal connection to James Harrison.
Yes, I do. He's I guess, one of my favourite people in my family, plus his father, whose name was William. He was also a great man.
So he was your, James Harrison was your great uncle, is that correct?
My great, great uncle.
Your great, great uncle.
Yes, he was.
And how much do you know about him?
Well, I'm the family historian, I guess you can say. And the very first day that I started looking for anybody, just anybody in my family, the only name I knew was James Harrison. So I went to the State Library in Sydney and asked the librarian where I should start. And she helped me, and we realised that that very day, that was the 100th anniversary of James's death. So my grandfather, he also told me about James. So, and he was a bit upset, I might say, that James was never given the recognition he deserved. So I'm just so pleased to hear so many lovely people calling in and giving James praise. It's been a long time coming for him. And also, I would like to say that his father and mother probably influenced him in a great way, because his father was a poet and his work is still being published today in Scotland. Yes, and his father was really a salmon fisherman and a weaver, nothing more.
Oh, they're pretty amazing. If you read James's biog, Rochelle, you really can't believe he could have fitted all this into his life. He was 78 when he died. He had 13 kids. He was married 13. Three times. He was widowed twice. It's quite an extraordinary story.
I actually haven't asked you, but how did he die?
Well, just caught a cold, really, but he was 78 and he was still experimenting at that stage of his life too, and keen to do things, and had this fairly sudden death in 1893. His grave is quite poignant too. It says, "One soweth, another reapeth," which sort of hints this biblical quote that perhaps he never was realised with what he achieved in this lifetime and rewarded as such. So quite a poignant little story on the grave. Yeah.
Considering how much, you know, and we've seen the outpouring of love and appreciation for him today, that you would hate to think that he died thinking, man, no one respected what I did, no one appreciated. One day they will thank me and they will open a museum in my honour. Just to the other end of the scale, Dee White. Now, Dee, you're a part of the Off-Grid Expo, and we're seeing a huge shift in people wanting to live off-grid. And many people I know in the UK are going to ground fridges, so a door that you then open up and you literally go down underground into an underground fridge. In the off-grid world in Victoria, will we ever see a shift to ground fridges here, do you think?
Well, thank you for inviting me onto your program. I think, yes, that we are certainly moving back to simpler times, and part of that is going off-grid, and with that, it's learning to not cope with connections to the corporate system. So, yes, I think you could very easily see, and I know of a couple of people who have already, I'm up here in Queensland, of course, but we've seen people build them, and they've built these underground rooms to store their product that they're growing on their land.
It's very topical, Dee. I interviewed a 91-year-old last week who had a lot of or new married life in the Mallee, and she said, we had this big underground cool room, and 13 steps down was mud brick, and then had cement sheet walls. It had a roof lined with seaweed. She said it was always 20 degrees cooler down there. And in those heat waves, she said, we used to put the kids' pool down there, and we would all, as a family, sit down there to escape the heat. But, you know, that was what people did pre-refrigeration. So what you're saying is really a bit of a look back to the past, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. It's a way of us being able to have storage without power, and most things can be stored underground as long as it's built correctly and you don't allow, you know, the air to get in and spoil food. Most food can be kept you know, for a longer period of time, about the same length of time as you could in a fridge.
Wow, you wouldn't want to be. I'm slightly claustrophobic, so even watching some of the footage of the people that go downstairs into their ground fridge and come back, you know, with a bunch of grapes and a litre of milk, the whole time I'm kind of holding my breath, freaking out that door's going to close and you get stuck in there.
What if it was a bottle of wine, Rochelle? Would that make a difference?
Well, maybe I'd do it. You know, like, you know, we all have our limits, don't we? Dee, thank you so much. It's fascinating to know whether or not that is where we'll see the shift of fridges. But for those that want to go back to look at some of this footage that we've been talking about, to look at that marked cave that we've seen, and to go into the world that you've just been in for, you know, the last couple of weeks researching this, Tim. Of course, it was on Landline yesterday, but people can go on to ABC iView as well, can't they, if they want to go back and have a look?
That's correct. And it's towards the end of the show if you want to spool through that 1 hour and for the segment. But yeah, really engaging one and a lot of fun to do.
And it's also up as an online story so people can go and have a look. And it's been a part of a series, I guess, of inventions around things that made rural Australia. Any hints as to what's coming up next?
We might go to the shearing sheds and see how we take the wool off sheep.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's something that I will leave to you. Hey, Tim Lee, as always, thank you so much. Take care and we'll speak with you soon.